Welcome, everyone. So glad you could join us for today's deep dive. We have got an incredibly fascinating stack of source material to get through today.
Yeah, it's really a great one.
It really is. We're looking at an excerpt from a heavily science-backed book that explores a concept you probably haven't thought much about, but one that honestly affects you every single day. It's the concept of healthy buildings.
Right.
And this text, it sits right at the intersection of health science, building science, and, you know, business.
Which is a really unique combination. It's a mix of fields that we don't often see communicating with one another. But when they do finally talk, I mean, the implications are massive.
Definitely. And the mission for our deep dive today is to uncover the reality of how the buildings we spend nearly all of our time in are secretly and constantly shaping our health.
Yeah.
And maybe even more surprisingly, we're going to look at why the business world has, for decades, just totally overlooked this massive opportunity to improve human performance.
Yeah. It really reframes how we think about well-being entirely. Like, when you consider improving your health, you likely think about changing your diet, starting a new exercise routine, or getting more sleep.
Sure, the usual stuff.
Exactly. The original text, however, argues that the building you are sitting in right now at this exact moment is actually one of the absolute biggest determinants of your overall well-being. It is a completely different paradigm for public health.
Okay, let's unpack this.
Yeah.
Because the text throws out a statistic early on that just sets the stage for everything else. We spend 90% of our time indoors.
90%.
Yeah. The text actually prompts the reader to calculate their indoor age. So to you listening right now, try this. Take your current age and multiply it by 0.9.
It's a fun little math equation.
Right. That number is the amount of time you have existed inside a box. If you live to be 80, you will have spent 72 years inside.
It is staggering when you actually do the math on your own life. You start to view the physical structures around you in a much more intimate way.
Oh, for sure. The author uses this striking analogy to put it in perspective. Human beings actually spend more time inside buildings than some species of whales spend underwater.
That's just wild.
We spend more time submerged in our indoor environments than they spend submerged in the ocean. We are quite literally an indoor species.
Which highlights a rather bizarre disconnect in how we manage our environment as a society. I mean, we have sweeping, comprehensive laws to regulate outdoor air quality.
Right, like the Clean Air Act in the U.S.
Exactly. We track outdoor particulate matter, ozone, carbon monoxide, sulfur dioxide. We have daily air quality indexes on our phones. But there is no equivalent comprehensive national indoor air quality standard, even though indoors is where we actually are all day long.
Yeah, it makes no sense when you frame it that way.
The text actually breaks this down into what it calls a three-pronged assault on our indoor health.
The first prong of that assault is what the author refers to as the dirty secret of outdoor air pollution, which is, how does outdoor pollution become an indoor problem?
The dirty secret is that most of your exposure to outdoor air pollution actually happens indoors.
Because buildings aren't bubbles.
Right. Buildings are not hermetically sealed bubbles. Their mechanical systems literally pull the outdoor air inside. So if you live in a city with smog or high PM 2.5.
And that's the really fine stuff.
Yes. Right. Particulate matter small enough to penetrate deep into your lungs. About half of that outdoor concentration makes its way inside your home or office. Because you spend over 21 hours a day indoors, taking about 1,000 breaths an hour, your total daily dose of outdoor pollution is primarily inhaled while you're just sitting on your couch or at your desk.
That fundamentally shifts the perspective on urban living. But prong two of this assault focuses on the pollution we actually generate inside. The text mentions this study done in Texas high schools, looking at their ventilation systems. What exactly were the researchers finding in the air?
They found a massive, distinct chemical signal of Axe body spray.
Axe body spray?
Yes. We are talking about VOCs, volatile organic compounds. These are chemicals that easily become vapors or gases at room temperature. Teenage boys wearing way too much cologne is a common trope, but the researchers actually saw it registering as a highly concentrated, measurable indoor air pollutant circulating through the school's HAAC system.
Unbelievable.
And it's not just cologne. These VOCs are continuously off-gassing from your furniture, your carpets, the paint on the walls, your dry cleaning, your laundry detergent.
I'm going to pause on that for a second, because there was also a Danish study mentioned in the text that tested how our bodies interact with these indoor pollutants. They put people in a room with specific chemicals, but they completely isolated their lungs. Can you break down how that experiment worked?
Yeah, the researchers wanted to know if we absorb indoor pollutants just by being in the room, even if we aren't breathing them in at all. They had subjects sit in the room with elevated levels of common indoor pollutants, specifically nicotine and plasticizers.
What exactly is a plasticizer in this context? Like, why is it just floating in the air?
Plasticizers are chemical additives used to make materials like PVC more flexible and durable. They're found in vinyl flooring, electrical cables, shower curtains, synthetic leathers. The issue is that they aren't tightly bound to the materials.
So they just leak out.
Exactly. They continuously shed into the surrounding air and settle into dust over the entire lifespan of the product. So in this Danish study, the subjects were stripped down to just their shorts to expose maximum skin, but they wore special hoods that provided completely clean, separate air to breathe.
So their lungs had zero contact with the contaminated room air.
None at all. A few days later, they tested their urine. The subjects still had those chemicals in their bodies.
Wow.
The study proved that human beings absorb plasticizers and nicotine directly through their skin from the indoor air. The skin is our largest organ, and it is highly porous. We are actively interacting with the chemical composition of our rooms through dermal absorption.
That is deeply unsettling. And that brings us to the third prong of the assault the neighbor effect. The text points out that even if you don't use harsh chemicals and you don't have vinyl flooring, you still might be breathing compromised air.
Depending on the design of your building, between 9 and 35% of the air you breathe inside might actually be coming from your neighbors.
35%.
Up to 35%. If you share walls or ventilation systems, air moves between those spaces due to pressure differentials. If your neighbor is smoking or cooking with poor ventilation, you are getting a portion of those particulates. And this applies heavily to commercial buildings, too.
Oh, yeah. The source material has a highly specific anecdote about an office building where the workers kept complaining that the air smelled like rodents. They hired pest control, tore the place apart, and found zero mice in the building. So where was the smell coming from?
Investigators eventually went outside and looked at the building's main air intake. It was located in an alleyway. Right next to it, exhausting air directly into that exact same alleyway, was the ventilation outtake for an animal toxicology lab next door.
A lab full of mice.
Exactly, a lab housing hundreds of mice and rats. The mechanical system of the office building was actively sucking in the exhaust from a mouse lab and distributing it directly to the office workers' desks.
Note to self, always check where the air intake is on my building.
What's fascinating here is a famous quote from Winston Churchill that the source material uses to frame this entire dynamic. Churchill said, "We shape our buildings, and afterwards our buildings shape us."
He was referring to politics and architecture when he said that, correct?
Yes, specifically the rebuilding of the UK Commons Chamber after it was destroyed by bombs in 1943. There was a strong push to make the new chamber bigger, perhaps utilizing a large semicircle design like many modern parliaments.
Right, something more spacious.
But Churchill insisted on keeping it small and intimate, essentially the size of a boxing ring. He understood that the cramped face-to-face architecture of that room forced a fierce adversarial style of debate. He contrasted it with the vast, detached U.S. House chamber, where representatives are far apart and the debate feels much less personal. The physical structure shaped the psychological behavior of the society.
That makes a lot of sense. And what this text does is take that architectural philosophy and apply it to our physical biology. We shaped our buildings, and now they are shaping our cellular health. And a huge turning point for this biological shaping was the energy crisis in the 1970s.
Because energy became incredibly expensive during that crisis, engineers decided the best way to save money on heating and cooling was to completely seal up our buildings. They wanted to make them airtight, stop making them so leaky so that conditioned air wouldn't escape.
From an energy-saving perspective, it was a massive success.
But from a human health perspective, it was a slow-moving disaster. By sealing up the buildings, we choked off the fresh air supply. This directly led to a phenomenon that became known as sick building syndrome.
Right.
Without fresh outdoor air diluting the indoor environment, all those VOCs from the furniture, all the off-gassing plasticizers, and all the carbon dioxide we exhale just get trapped and build up continuously.
The text uses a great analogy for this that anyone who drives will understand. Think about being on the highway in your car. If you roll up all the windows, the car becomes quiet, aerodynamic, and fuel efficient.
Very efficient.
But very quickly, the carbon dioxide from your own breath starts to spike. All the off-gassing from the plastic dashboard gets trapped. You start to get sleepy, you get a headache, your reaction time slows down.
That is sick building syndrome on a micro scale. And the science on carbon dioxide is particularly revealing here. We used to think CO2 was just a benign gas that displaced oxygen, but recent studies show it acts as a direct pollutant that impairs higher-level executive function.
Meaning it actually makes us think worse?
Exactly. When CO2 levels rise in a sealed conference room, people literally lose their ability to strategize and make complex decisions. We effectively rolled up the windows on our entire civilization to save on the heating bill, and we've been operating in a state of mild cognitive impairment ever since.
So if our buildings are effectively making us sick, figuring out how they're doing it is less about traditional medicine and more about investigating a crime scene. Which brings us to the author's rather unique background before he entered the field of public health.
It is a perfect background for diagnosing these invisible issues. Before becoming a leading public health scientist at Harvard, the author was a private investigator in New York City. He was conducting surveillance, locating missing persons, a process known as skip tracing, and investigating complex cases.
He eventually applied to join the FBI, and the story of his polygraph test in the text is wild. How did a private investigator end up failing the final hurdle for the FBI?
He passed all the grueling tests, the background checks, the intense interrogations. The very last step was a polygraph test. He failed it initially because an unskilled examiner asked him poorly constructed questions.
Okay.
So the FBI then flew in a top-tier interrogator, a highly intimidating individual who applied intense pressure for hours. The author, relying on his investigator training, stayed perfectly calm, assuming it was just a psychological stress test. Because he didn't react with the expected baseline anxiety, he failed again. They accused him of using countermeasures to artificially beat the machine.
That has been incredibly frustrating, but it set up a major pivot. The exact same day he failed that final FBI polygraph, he walked into his first day of classes at public health school.
He took that forensic investigator mindset, the ability to look at a complex system, find the hidden variables, and track invisible clues, and applied it to exposure risk science in sick buildings.
That unique blend of skills proved critical when his team was called to investigate a severe situation at Grady Hospital in Atlanta. The hospital was dealing with a deadly outbreak of Legionnaire's disease.
Legionnaires is a severe, often lethal form of pneumonia caused by Legionella bacteria. This bacteria naturally occurs in water, but it thrives and multiplies in lukewarm, stagnant water environments. In a massive, complex building like a hospital, you often find it in what plumbers call dead legs.
Dead legs.
Yeah, these are sections of pipe that have been capped off during renovations and no longer have water flowing through them. The water just sits there, slowly warming to room temperature, creating a perfect breeding ground.
But drinking the bacteria usually isn't what gets you sick. It has to be aerosolized. You have to breathe the contaminated water droplets deep into your lungs.
Hospitals are full of places where water is aerosolized, particularly patient showers. So you have this bacteria brewing in a stagnant pipe, eventually making its way to a shower head and infecting highly vulnerable patients. At Grady Hospital, 4 patients caught the disease on the same 2 floors in a single month. The author's team went in, mapped the plumbing infrastructure like a detective mapping a syndicate, and stopped the outbreak. They implemented a comprehensive system upgrade involving water filters, shock treatments, and hot water heater upgrades. It cost millions of dollars, but it eradicated the issue permanently.
If we contrast that success story with another hospital mentioned in the text, things get much darker.
If we connect this to the bigger picture, we run into the core structural problem with how buildings are managed today. At a different unnamed hospital, a very similar outbreak occurred. But in this case, a patient died.
Tragic.
The hospital was sued and ended up paying millions of dollars in an insurance settlement. The author was brought in as an expert witness and pitched the hospital a proactive, permanent risk management plan to guarantee this would never happen again. The cost of this preventative plan was $20,000.
They just paid out millions for a death, and they were offered a permanent fix for $20,000. How did the hospital administration respond?
They refused to pay it.
That makes no sense.
It makes zero logical sense until you understand the underlying business flaw in commercial real estate, which is called split incentives.
How does a split incentive make turning down a $20,000 fix a rational business decision for them?
Because the multi-million dollar settlement was paid by the hospital's overarching insurance policy. It was a massive payout, but it barely touched the hospital's day-to-day operating budget. However, that $20,000 prevention plan, that would have to be paid directly out of the facility manager's annual maintenance budget. And the facility manager is not incentivized based on patient health outcomes. Their annual bonus is often tied to keeping the building's maintenance costs as low as possible.
The financial structure of the building actively punishes the person in charge for investing in health.
The people making the financial decisions for the physical building are operating in a silo, completely disconnected from the health and liability outcomes of the enterprise occupying the building.
Here's where it gets really interesting, because this blind spot goes way beyond hospitals. It affects our schools and our offices, too. The text brings up a quote from former U.S. Secretary of Education Betsy DeVos, where she stated, "We should be funding students, not school buildings." The source material actually uses that quote to highlight a major contrast, pointing out that over 200 scientific studies in the text show a totally different reality, that the building itself is a primary driver of student success.
The data from those studies is definitive. They found that placing a student in a poorly ventilated classroom drops their attention power by 5%. To give that context, researchers equated that specific cognitive drop to the effect of a student skipping breakfast. You can give a student the best curriculum and the best teacher, but if the room is starved of oxygen, their brain physically cannot process the information at full capacity.
There was also a massive study in New York City looking at temperature and testing.
They looked at nearly a million exam records. They found that taking a test on a 90-degree day versus a 75-degree day increases the likelihood of failing that exam by 14%.
14% just from the heat?
Yes. The human body expends immense amounts of energy on thermoregulation. When the building fails to regulate the temperature, the student's brain has to divert energy away from cognitive processing and problem solving just to keep the body cool. You literally cannot invest in the student without investing in the building, because the building is the environment dictating their cognitive capacity.
Zooming out to the corporate world, this same logic applies to office buildings. The text introduces a fundamental rule of commercial real estate called the 330-300 rule.
It is a general rule of thumb that outlines how companies spend their money per square foot of office space annually. Roughly speaking, a company spends about $3 per square foot on utilities like electricity, water, and heating. They spend about $30 per square foot on rent, the physical real estate itself. And they spend $300 per square foot on payroll, the salaries, benefits, and output of the human beings sitting in that space.
$3 for utilities, $30 for rent, $300 for people.
And here is the crucial insight, the massive blind spot of the business world. For the past few decades, the entire green building movement has been obsessively focused on the $3. We spent trillions of dollars globally trying to shave fractions of a penny off our energy bills. We sealed up the buildings, we reduced ventilation rates, we installed hyper-efficient windows, all to lower that $3 utility cost while completely ignoring the $300 cost to people.
It's the definition of stepping over dollars to pick up pennies. If poor air quality and high carbon dioxide drop cognitive function by 5% and increase sick days, a company is effectively damaging its most expensive asset, its human capital. Saving 50 cents a square foot on heating is irrelevant if you were losing $30 a square foot in lost productivity and sick leave.
It's a profound misallocation of resources, but the text argues that we are on the cusp of a major paradigm shift, driven by what it calls global mega changes. We have an aging global population that is more susceptible to respiratory and environmental health issues. We also have extreme urbanization happening at a scale never seen before in human history.
The statistic in the text about India's urbanization is hard to even visualize.
India is expected to add the equivalent of a Paris-sized city to its urban areas every 2 months between now and 2050.
Every 2 months.
When you consider the sheer volume of concrete, enclosed spaces, and mechanical ventilation systems that represents, getting the indoor environment right becomes a global health imperative. And all of this is happening against the backdrop of a massive shift in the financial sector toward ESG investing, environmental, social, and governance.
Institutional capital is demanding that real estate assets demonstrate positive social performance, not just energy efficiency.
Trillions of dollars are moving toward properties that can prove they are healthy for the occupants. And the smartest companies are already figuring this out. The text uses Google as a prime example. Google doesn't view its buildings as overhead costs to be minimized. They view their buildings as the product, and their employees are the users of that product.
There is an amazing anecdote about Larry Page, the co-founder of Google, regarding this exact philosophy. He literally walks around carrying a personal air quality monitor, During a meeting, he took it out and started pounding a piece of carpet to show everyone the invisible, toxic little dust clouds of VOCs and particulates they were all breathing in.
When executive leadership is walking around with an air quality sensor, it changes the entire culture of facilities management. The split incentive disappears because health is prioritized from the top down. And this is the future the text envisions. Historically, measuring the health of an indoor space required expensive equipment and laboratory analysis. But now, we are living through a sensor revolution. Cheap, continuous sensor technology allows us to make the invisible visible.
We can track carbon dioxide, VOCs, humidity, and particulate matter in real time, right from our phones.
We can merge health science, building science, and business science to create dynamic environments. If a conference room gets crowded and CO2 spikes, the building software can automatically increase the fresh air intake for that specific room, actively optimizing the cognitive performance of the people inside.
So what does this all mean? If we synthesize everything from these sources, the core takeaway is that we have to stop looking at our buildings as just passive shelters or sunk costs on a balance sheet. They are active human resource tools. They are health interventions. Managing a building for health isn't just a nice-to-have perk. It is the ultimate win-win. It improves public well-being, prevents disease transmission, and drastically boosts corporate bottom lines through improved cognitive function and productivity.
This raises an important question for you listening to this right now. Think about that 90% of your life you spend indoors. Right now, take a look around the room you are in. Are you managing your environment, or is it managing you? Is the air you're breathing helping your brain focus, or is the chemical composition of the room quietly draining your energy?
It really makes you rethink every room you walk into and where the air intake for that room might be.
And I want to leave you with a final thought to mull over, building on what we've learned today. We spent the last 50 years sealing our buildings up, making them completely airtight to save energy during a crisis. Now look at the next 50 years, which will be defined by climate change, rising temperatures, and increasingly extreme outdoor environments like wildfire smoke and urban smog. Will our buildings become our only true safe havens from an increasingly hostile outdoor world? Or, if we don't fundamentally fix our ventilation and understand indoor air quality, will they become airtight traps that magnify the very pollutants we are trying to escape? Next time you take a deep breath indoors, think about what you're really breathing in.